Today at Reader's Corner, Sam Halverhovic, author of Jet Age, The Comet, The 707, and The Race to Shrink the World.
Pan Am, the predominant U.S. airline, the great international carrier, shook up the U.S. industry by ordering the Comet, which would have been the first time ever that an American airline had flown a plane manufactured outside of the United States. The Comet failure was, in a way, as grievous a blow to British pride as was the sinking of the Titanic. The biggest thing that people want out of flying, they want it to be inexpensive. And the planes have to cram as many people in as you can efficiently and safely do. That's pretty much how the 707 was designed.
I'm Bob Custer, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. The internet is credited with connecting the world, but Gmail can't put you in the arms of a loved one in Ireland, or Twitter won't deliver Australian lobster to your door. Air travel makes these and so many other things possible. Given the now ubiquitous nature of commercial flight, it is hard to imagine that until 1958, more people crossed the Atlantic Ocean aboard ships than planes, and fewer than 1 in 10 Americans had ever been airborne. In Jet Age, The Comet, The 707, and The Race to Shrink the World, journalist Sam Halverhovic explores the amazing race to produce the first generation of jet airliners and the visionary individuals who designed, built, and flew them. From the myth of Icarus to the Wright brothers' triumph at Kitty Hawk and the aviation marvels of today, Mr. Verhovic tells an electrifying tale about the indomitable human spirit and dream of flight. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Mr. Verhovic, a former national correspondent for the New York Times and Los Angeles Times. He lives in Seattle, where he joined us by phone. Sam Verhovic, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you very much, Bob. Thanks.
Well, let's start with this issue of the contest that TWA launched in 1955, promising $50,000 to whoever most accurately portrayed what commercial aviation would look like in 30 years. You were a young New York Times reporter. You covered the announcement of the winner in 1986. What can you tell us about that and the extent that it influenced your career?
That was one of my very first stories that I did for the New York Times, and I absolutely loved it because there were so many just wild, very futuristic predictions of you know, that everybody would be able to fly in their own personal airplane, that all the planes would be pilotless, that we would be having nuclear reactors aboard planes that would allow us to go much faster. The woman who actually won the contest had long since forgotten that she'd ever even entered it, but 30 years later, she happened to be living in the same house as when she entered it, and she had a very, you know, correct sort of characterization of how big the planes would be and how fast everybody would be flying around and so forth. Although, you know, one of the remarkable things to me is that really 50 years after the first jet airplane started carrying passengers, we're really not flying around any more comfortably and certainly any more quickly than we were in 1958 when the 707 started to fly.
Well, that thought's occurred to me any number of times as I board the 737 that takes me over to Seattle or Portland via Southwest Airlines or whatever. It really isn't any different. I mean, for 30 years, I've probably been flying the same speed in the same kind of aircraft, slightly upgraded for quality, probably upgraded for safety. That's real important to me, as it is all who fly. But the question is, why? Air travel hasn't changed much. I know in one part of your book, you say, well, that's because they got it right the first time. But there aren't many areas of manufacturing that would settle for that excuse. They'd say, excuse me, we've got work to do on with the next generation. Is it the safety factor that perhaps has limited our ability to continue moving forward at the same pace we see other endeavors do so?
Well, there are a couple of things. And first of all, when I said in the book that they got it right the first time around, I was referring to the Boeing engineers who did the 707, because they did basically build an incredibly successful airplane. The very first jet airliner, this British plane, the Comet, the de Havilland Comet, was the first, and that they did not get right the first time around. It was a tragically flawed airplane that had three horrific mid-air explosions that in each case killed everybody aboard. And so it was very much a case that Boeing was sort of, you know, your classic second adopter that learned a bit from the mistakes and, you know, produced the thing that worked. The great difference is 50 years later, they certainly are safer to some degree, although the 707 proved itself to be pretty darn safe. And we're flying around much, much more inexpensively in relative dollars than we were in 1958. But in a way, your question is answered by the fact that the biggest thing that people want out of flying, as much as they complain about the service and so forth, they want it to be inexpensive. And given that they want it to be inexpensive, the planes sort of automatically have to kind of cram as many people in as you can efficiently and safely do. And, you know, that's pretty much how the 707 was designed. So there we are.
Well, you mentioned the de Havilland Comet. Let's talk about the de Havilland Comet for a moment. It was, I guess, the first jetliner to successfully move beyond prop flight and take large numbers of passengers across the seas. And yet, as you said, it was tragically flawed, caused a number of deaths due to the accidents over the water. But if you could take us to the pioneer, Geoffrey de Havilland. This comet was something really special in that Britain had made it a point to be the premier in this field.
Absolutely. And coming out of World War II, the Brits certainly had done a lot of work on the jet engine in the context of trying to catch up with the Germans, who were the very first to have an operational jet fighter. And Britain was determined after the war, even though it was, you know, on its knees economically and still in, you know, so many ways in bad shape. There was rationing still in effect in Great Britain up until 54. It was a tough, tough time. And they felt that they could stake a huge amount of money and really, you know, national prestige on the idea that they could be the world leaders with this amazing new product, with a jet airliner. And so while American manufacturers, they were sort of convincing themselves that they needed to wait on the jet airliner, that it was another, you know, 5 or 10 or more years off, the Brits just jumped whole hog into it and built this airplane. De Havilland himself was a remarkable character, very obsessed with the idea of building, you know, ever faster airplanes, even though two of his three sons had been killed in crashes involving his company's airplanes, one in a wartime training exercise. The other, his eldest son, namesake son, crashed trying to set a world speed record in a experimental plane. And, you know, I think for a lot of us, if we lost even one of our kids in an airplane that we were building, we might stop doing it. But he didn't. He really saw this as a mission, and he pushed it. And with a fair amount of government backing, Great Britain started flying this plane. Well, in 1949 was the first test flight of it. It started carrying passengers in 1952. And it took the world by storm, was quite a successful thing for about a year, and then a year to the day after the first commercial service, a plane blew apart just after taking off from India. And then there were two other accidents a few months later, both over Italy, that finally resulted in the plane being grounded.
And that brings in Arnold Hall, who is eventually called upon to investigate?
Yes. He was a brilliant aeronautics professor and sort of a wunderkind of the British aviation industry, and his big job was to try to find out what this mysterious, deadly flaw was of the comet in what turned out to be really sort of the quixotic hope that somehow they could find and fix this problem right away and come back with a redesigned airplane that could still keep this lead that they had built in technology. And he did an amazing thing. You know, the comet failure, once it was clear that the plane did have this flaw, was in a way as grievous a blow to British pride as was the sinking of the Titanic. And people were very concerned with trying to figure out what was wrong. And he did all these amazing tests. He took a comet and literally sort of sunk it into basically a giant swimming pool in an effort to recreate the compression and decompression cycles that an airplane goes through when it flies. And, you know, it took him several months, but he did find exactly what the flaw was.
But in the meantime, what, not more than 10 weeks after the investigation started, they put the aircraft back in service, didn't they?
Well, after the first crash over India and a couple of other crashes that were less severe, crashes on takeoff that involved a separate flaw of the airplane, the British government authorities still pronounced the plane basically flight worthy. They wound up sort of writing off the Indian accident to a, you know, freak thunderstorm, lightning storm. And even after the second comet blew up over Italy, they took it out of service for several weeks, looked at it, made a couple of modifications, but then again pronounced their confidence in it. They even said that they thought maybe it was sabotage. They still weren't quite sure. And 16 days after the comet started flying after the second accident, yet another one blew up right after taking off from Rome. And that was the point at which they were all taken out of service, and the government finally acknowledged that it was fatally flawed.
From reading your account, it sure sounds like they tolerated uncertainty and accidents more than now.
Yes, and one thing I do point out in the book is that there were more air crashes. There were certainly a greater number of air crashes because you had sort of smaller sized airplanes, which meant in a way that, you know, there were more airplanes flying relatively than there might be today with much bigger planes. And also, you know, the DC-4 had two or three crashes that year. The DC-6 had a couple. Nobody talked about taking them out of service. Still, the Comet was a, you know, a brand new technology, a completely different kind of plane. And it is, I mean, I can't really defend the British decision to keep it in service. It obviously turned out in retrospect to be a terrible decision, and it was a death trap that was put up into the skies.
In preparation for this interview, I decided to Google de Havilland Comet jet airliner, and I came up with this remarkable old British newsreel that starts off very optimistically about what a great airliner this is, and it's flying all over the world, and this guy who's doing the reporting is on the plane as they're coming into Rome and going over the Colosseum. And of course, as the newsreel advances, the British Navy is picking up parts of one of the planes that crashed, and they're talking about these accidents and what caused them. And that's the next question I have for you, is what did cause those crashes, and what did they learn from it? How does that manifest itself in the way we look out of a window today in an airplane?
Well, they did ultimately find that the flaw was sort of ironically not due to any deficiency in the jet engine technology itself. It was basically a problem of metal fatigue. They didn't fully understand the effects of the compression and decompression cycles. The aluminum was not quite thick enough, and another contributing factor was that the British designers had very much insisted on having these neatly squared windows because they wanted to differentiate the windows of the Jet Comet from the porthole windows, rounded windows, of a ship. And in every case of the catastrophic mid-air explosions, the microscopic crack, the beginning of metal fatigue, happened at the corner of one of these windows. And that is certainly one of the reasons why virtually all airplanes, you know, jet airliners today have the rounded windows. Although even if they had square windows, the advances in understanding of metal fatigue would prevent them from having such a catastrophic failure. You know, that we'll get into the 707. The Boeing company actually literally produced a film, which I think you can also get on YouTube, called Operation Guillotine, that literally showed a guillotine blade dropping down into the fuselage of a 707 to establish that even that kind of a rip wouldn't result in catastrophic decompression of the plane. The ripstop construction would basically limit the damage of a tear.
Before we get to the 707, I do want to ask about the American carriers. Were they were ordering Comets from Britain during this time, weren't they?
Well, except that one of the ways in which this story, to me, is a classic great business story that really kind of has resonance for today. We all, you know, debate whether Apple or Google or Microsoft is going to, you know, rule the world of of computers and software and so forth, when in fact it's probably some fourth company that, you know, none of us have even heard of yet, maybe hasn't even been invented yet, that will overtake the market. The American manufacturers and the airlines were making so much money and doing so well with the great four-engine propeller-driven planes of the era that they basically found a lot of reasons to hold off on doing jet airliners. And it was only until the British planes started to fly that all of a sudden the American industry sort of woke up. It was kind of a slap in the face that the British had, you know, beat everybody with this thing. People in Congress were demanding to know, you know, why the American industry didn't have a jetliner in the works. And Pan Am, which was the predominant U.S. airline, the great international carrier, shook up the U.S. industry by ordering the Comet, which would have been the first time ever that an American airline had flown a plane manufactured outside of the United States. And Pan Am obviously canceled its order for the Comets after the accidents.
You're listening to Sam Howe Verhovic. He is the author of Jet Age, The Comet, The 707, and The Race to Shrink the World. So let's talk about one of those American corporate leaders that really did get Boeing off the stick and into this business, and that's Bill Allen. Is he the guy that's credited with really making this happen?
Bill Allen, absolutely. And he as the head of this, you know, what is now the world's most successful airplane manufacturer, and Juan Trip of Pan Am were the two big characters in this drama. But Allen is sort of less known. He was a little more plotting and self-effacing as a character than Juan Trip was. But in a way, to me, I wound up thinking that he was really one of the most visionary and successful business executives of the century. When he took over Boeing, it was known as a successful military airplane manufacturer, but it was basically a three-time loser in the commercial prop airliner business. And this little Seattle company had less than 1% of the commercial airliner market in 1950, when he basically began to really think about a jet airliner and decided to push his board to basically bet the company on going ahead and building a jet airliner before either of the two industry heavyweights, Douglas and Lockheed, were willing to make that commitment.
And he wasn't a flyboy, as they say. He wasn't a Howard Hughes type of guy that liked to get into the cockpit and fly. Had he ever flown? I mean, he was really a lawyer.
He was not a pilot. He was a lawyer. He was a small-town Montana kid. He grew up in the Lolo Mountains, went to the University of Montana, did go on to Harvard Law School, became a lawyer, and essentially was Bill Boeing's kind of right-hand man as the lawyer for not only Boeing's airplane business, but before that for his, you know, timber and lumber business. Allen was very much an accidental president of Boeing. The guy who had led the company, Phil Johnson, quite brilliantly through World War II, as Boeing built some of the great, you know, sort of long-distance troop transport and bombers that helped to win the war. Phil Johnson, the guy who was going to figure out how to somehow get Boeing into the commercial game, dropped dead of a brain hemorrhage right toward the end of World War II. It was a shock to everybody in the industry, and Boeing did not have an obvious candidate to lead the company. They didn't, you know, all other things being equal, they would have wanted an engineer, a builder, a designer, a guy who really knew airplanes. Bill Allen had good judgment, but he was not known by anybody as an airplane guy. He was not a pilot. He was not an engineer. He was not somebody who was particularly fascinated with flight, at least at the beginning. But he was a guy who clearly had sound judgment and good leadership skills, and he turned out to be the right guy at the right time.
So Boeing brings innovation to flying and to aircraft manufacturing. And one term that I think I heard you talk about is rip-top construction.
Rip-stop construction.
Rip-stop.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Well, that was a little bit a response in some ways to the de Havilland Comet. With ripstop construction, it's almost a little bit like the staves of a barrel. If you think about it, if you had a pressurized barrel and you cut into the barrel, you would have sort of a failure at the one section in between the two staves of that barrel, but the rest of the barrel would not all of a sudden completely decompress or fall apart. And if you think about it, there have been accidents up until this day where a modern airliner has had a gash in it. It certainly results in a somewhat of a loss of compression. The plane, you know, drops down, and it's the oxygen tanks come down and all that. But all recent incidents, including a 747 just a couple of months ago, the airplane can still get down safely onto the ground and land someplace, which a de Havilland Comet was completely incapable of doing. Once that tear reached sort of critical mass, it just it was like a piece of cloth ripping, and the airplane just blew apart. So that was one of Boeing's innovations. And, you know, Boeing had started to build military planes with jets, so it obviously had a certain advantage to bring to the table. But everybody thought the Douglas would be the one that would eventually prevail with a jet airliner. And the DC-8 almost did beat out the 707.
So was the precursor to the 707 what you refer to in your book as the Dash 80?
Yeah, the Dash 80 was the prototype airplane for the 707, which turned out that this, by the way, was the $16 million investment that the company made, which was a huge amount of money at the time and represented, as I said, this great gamble. It was one of the brilliant things behind the Dash 80, the prototype, was that it was also the prototype for a potential military airplane, in particular a refueler, a tanker. So Boeing was really able to take this one airplane and go to the military and say, you know, here's what we can build for you using this as the base. It could also go to the airlines and say, and here's our base for a passenger plane. The Dash 80 is a very historic airplane. It's now at the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum in D.C., or actually at Dulles Airport in Virginia. And it was the plane that famously, at least in Seattle, was executed a double barrel roll over a crowd of 350,000 people in 1955.
Well, tell us about Alvin Tex Johnston, who was the guy who pulled that off, and describe what happened during that time. That's something that could never happen today. I think he did it over Lake Washington, right in the middle of metropolitan Seattle. But you can give us the details on that. And also, didn't he serve as a model for a very famous movie character later on?
Yeah, Tex Johnston had all of sort of the bravado and the swagger and the outsized kind of character that Bill Allen really sort of kept in check and didn't exhibit. He did, in fact, serve as a model in part because he liked to fly in his Stetson and his cowboy boots for the famous Slim Pickens character in Doctor Strangelove. You know, the guy who right. at the very end, when they're American Ingenuity, they're trying to figure out how to get the nuclear bomb to be able to drop on Soviet Union. He gets down on top of the bomb and releases it. And Johnston really reveled in this sort of image. He also, though, was a supremely skilled and, in his own way, very careful pilot. And anybody who survives as a test pilot, given all the various kinds of planes he flew across his career, obviously had some skill. And when I started the research for the book, I knew vaguely. I'd always heard about this barrel roll over Lake Washington during the Gold Cup races, with not only 350,000, you know, Seattle spectators there, but also all of the leaders of the airline and aviation industries who were in town for a conference at the time. I found it sort of inconceivable that he could have done this without some authorization from the company, from Allen or from one of the marketing people or whatever. And it just turns out that is absolutely not the case. It was completely unauthorized, unexpected. The only person who had any idea that he was going to do it was his co-pilot, who he told about 15 minutes before he executed the maneuver. And you can actually see this if you, again, go to, you know, Google, YouTube. It's grainy film, but it is it's classic, and you can certainly see this plane, you know, kind of roar in down toward Lake Washington, and all of a sudden sort of go into this turn that at first you think, God, this plane's going out of control. And in fact, Bill Allen, the president of Boeing, the guy whose $18 million baby was up overhead, at first felt sick to his stomach. He thought that the plane was going to veer out of control, that there was some problem. The plane continues on and executes a complete 360-degree roll, and then it goes up, turns down, comes in again, and does another full barrel roll over Lake Washington. And at this point, Bill Allen was no longer sick to his stomach. Now he was irate over what he knew Tex Johnston to be doing, which was, you know, a classic old barnstorming stunt with a $18 million plane that was going to revolutionize the world.
Now, that was about the time that American Airlines comes in and gives Boeing a big order for these planes. Did this stunt have something to do with it?
You know, to their dying days, it's really fascinating to me. To their dying days, Bill Allen and Tex Johnston disagreed, and in a way quite bitterly, over whether this maneuver was a brilliant act of showmanship, salesmanship, and marketing, which is what Tex Johnston believed it to be, or whether it was a, you know, reckless, kind of unforgivable stunt, as Bill Allen considered it. It certainly got people in the industry talking, and a few months afterwards, Pan Am announced a big order, biggest order by far ever of commercial airliners, but Juan Trip sort of split the baby, and he ordered 20 Boeing 707s, which were going to come first and allow him to be the first American carrier with jet airplanes. But he also ordered 25 DC-8s by Douglas because he thought, as the way that a lot of people in the industry sort of thought at the time, that Douglas was the more reliable manufacturer of commercial airplanes. So Juan Trip sort of hedged his bet. It was only the other airlines that came around a bit later that sort of opted for the 707 that gave it the lead that it never gave up. And the 707 really wound up being the more successful of the two airplanes. It's the iconic plane of the early jet age.
Was the 707 the first Air Force One?
Yes, it was. It's in a military configuration where it's known as the VC-137, but it was in fact the first jet airliner or jet plane to serve as Air Force One. And there were three of them ultimately made, and among other sort of claims to fame of it, it certainly was the airplane on which aboard which Lyndon Johnson was sworn into office after John F. Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas. That famous picture is Johnson inside the plane raising his hand. I believe that both his wife and Jacqueline Kennedy are alongside him. The plane is on the ground there. Kennedy's casket, his body, has been put into the plane, and it took off shortly afterwards with LBJ as the new president.
You tell an interesting side story that I was unaware of regarding Khrushchev's role in helping America get to the point of having an Air Force One and what it would be.
Khrushchev was quite obsessed with having his own jet airplane. And in fact, the Soviets, it was sort of a minor Sputnik moment. The Soviets did create a jet airliner which served in one model as Khrushchev's plane and also flew passengers at terrific cost to the government between Moscow and a couple of cities way out in Siberia. But they did have this period of time after the Comet was taken out of service where the Soviets were the only people in the world that had a jet airliner. And a lot of American politicians and Eisenhower, to some degree, were sort of ticked off. So they, in fact, went to Boeing and said, we need you to build us an airplane, a jet airliner. And that's how we got Air Force One as a 707.
Well, Sam, we've run out of time. We haven't covered all of your book yet, so I do advise listeners to get a copy of Jet Age, The Comet, The 707, and The Race to Shrink the World. Sam Howell-Verhovic, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Sam Verhovic. Next week, Matthew Algio, author of The President is a Sick Man, wherein the supposedly virtuous Grover Cleveland survives a secret surgery at sea and vilifies the courageous newspaper man who dared expose the truth. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Aaron Ryan. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.